You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Mark Stout, historian of the museum. I'm a PhD author and historian who served for 13 years as an analyst in the U.S. intelligence community. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. Today, we're going to talk about intelligence and espionage in America's forgotten war, the Korean War. You'll recall that in June 1950, the Korean War started when communist North Korean forces stormed across the border into the South. The United States and the United Nations soon joined in, helping to defend the South. Later, China entered the war, almost hurling American forces right off the Korean Peninsula. The war actually went on until July 1953 when the armistice was signed, though technically there hasn't been a peace treaty, so technically a state of war continues on the Korean Peninsula to this day. Today we have two really distinguished visitors here who can talk about that war and, more importantly for our purposes, about intelligence and espionage in it. We have Colonel Douglas Dillard and Mr. James M.H. Lee. Colonel Dillard is a career U.S. Army intelligence officer, had many assignments around the U.S. Army, was a young lieutenant in Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France in 1944 and World War II, where he had then occasion to work with the French resistance in the Maritime Alps, subsequently served in the Korean War, later on in the Vietnam War, and he retired in 1977 from the Defense Intelligence Agency. We also have with us Mr. Lee, who also has a long and distinguished career in the United States government. He retired in 1994 with 41 years of service, almost 30 of it at the United Nations Military Armistice Commission. Also in the 1950s, Mr. Lee was a translator for the G2, that's the intelligence shop, of the 1st Marine Division, and later a project officer for various intelligence operations in Korea that we'll hear about today. Interestingly, Mr. Lee is himself originally from North Korea, and in 2002, he got a rare opportunity to visit North Korea, not only Pyongyang, but to actually visit his old hometown, an opportunity not vouchsafed to many North Koreans. So, we'll start with Colonel Dillard. Colonel Dillard, in 1952, you are a lieutenant, and you arrive in Korea, and you're assigned to something called the 8240th Army Unit. Can you tell us a little bit about this strangely named unit and what its function was?
The unit was directly under the control of General Willoughby, MacArthur's G2.
So MacArthur's intelligence officer.
Therefore, it was supported 8th Army, but was not under any 8th Army control. And it ran two divisions. One was an intelligence division, which Mr. Lee and I were a part of, and I was with the both the aviary and TLO for a while. The other division was the partisan division, and we referred to North Korean irregulars as guerrillas and the South Korean agents, as partisans, to have a difference in the terminology. And the operations were based on the offshore islands off the west coast of Korea, from the Yalu River all the way down to the Han River.
So the islands off of the North Korean coast,
yes,
these partisans were operating,
yes,
from.
Yes, and on the east coast, they had less success because of the mountainous terrain and the difficulty in your mobility, moving around and concealing your operations. there were boat operations with landings on both coasts. And, of course, the airborne was aviary. And then the line crossers, which were TLO. And there was a
And TLO stands for?
Tactical Liaison Office.
And a nice generic name, like so many names in the intelligence business.
Yes, of course. And the TLO teams consisted of approximately five personnel, and one officer and four or five enlisted men. And then the agents that they used to cross the lines collecting tactical intelligence. There were both male and female agents. As a matter of fact, some of the female ladies had babies. And in the early stages of the war, when the line was very fluid, the ladies would take their baby and then they could claim, if they were stopped by a North Korean or Chinese, that they were separated from their family and they were trying to get relocated, relocate their family, and therefore escape. But that didn't work all the time. So we had within the 8240th Army Unit now a joint operation that began in the latter part of 1951, because before that time, there were various activities, but they were all controlled by different units, such as the Far East Command, the CIA, 8th Army. And now we have the first cohesive effort within the 40th.
Okay. So if I understand your biography, then, when you came to this, sort of mess in some sense bureaucratically that was the 8240th, you were put in charge of something called Aviary or Operation Aviary. You mentioned it briefly. Can you focus on what did Aviary do? What was their function within
Operation Aviary was comprised of two officers and about 10 or 12 or 15. It varied depending on our replacement effectiveness. And these were all very experienced airborne troopers that practically all of them had been in World War II. As my people rotated, I had a constant supply of very experienced jump masters. And that's what we really needed, because first we had to do the map reconnaissance jointly with the Air Force and select the drop zone that we could hit within the vicinity of the target, whether it be for an agent drop or a partisan unit drop. And we conducted then resupply missions to keep these operations that were still ongoing behind the lines, and did radio intercepts. And we'd have an interpreter in the plane and fly over an area and pick up a quick report of OB information, or just
OB being
order of battle, or okay. Determine the team was still operating.
So Aviary then was basically an operation to insert and supply and perhaps also extract Koreans and Chinese as intelligence agents behind the North Korean lines, and also to perform similar functions for the Korean partisans. Then.
Right.
Okay. For the sake of our listeners, can you distinguish? You've mentioned here dropping in agents. You've also mentioned supporting partisans. Can you tell me what were these agents meant to do, and how many of them would go in at one time? And how does that compare with what the partisans were doing, and the sort of the size of the partisan effort? Help us distinguish those two different kinds of functions: agents versus partisans.
On the offshore islands, there were various partisan units, and they were given a name of either an element of Wolfpack, which operated in one area, and Leopard that operated in another area. But then to identify them simply, they were all called donkey teams, donkey. 1 through 24. And they were out on these islands and would conduct short penetration operations with a boat landing and either raid or sabotage a village and try and capture the local communist officials, or kill them if they put up a fight, or blow bridges, or do other things to damage the infrastructure on the coast. And it was so effective that the Chinese had to devote a division to the coastal area to prohibit that. And every now and then they would run a raid on the island, and partisans would have to flee south until they withdrew. They'd come on and do a quick operation to dismantle that operation. Then they'd go back on the peninsula. As a matter of fact, the island that was shelled yesterday was the base for a Leopard operation. Pyongyang, we called it in those days. They call it a little different name now.
So the partisans were there basically to harass the North Korean forces and the Chinese forces behind their lines, much in the same way, then, correct me if I'm wrong, that, say, the French resistance or the Yugoslav partisans during World War II were harassing the German occupiers.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. The agents were different. Yes. They could drop either one agent or three or four agents, and I'm sure Mr. Lee can comment on some of that himself, but we would have four or five aircraft every night during the moon phase so that we could fly in those mountains. And quite often the agent was selected to go to an area that he initially came from, because most of our agents were North Korean, practically all of them, as a matter of fact. And the idea was that they could go back and mingle with their family or friends and develop a net. And in some cases, we equip them with a radio. And I know in once—
If I can interrupt you, develop a net. You mean a net of agents to report to them, of sources to report to them, and they would report this intelligence information back to the United States and the UN command.
That's correct.
Okay,
in Wangye Province, which is it borders on the DMZ. As a matter of fact, it's split. There were so many cooperating people there that the intelligence net spread almost all the way across that particular state or province, as they call it. And it was very effective. Up north, it was a little more difficult. And sometimes the operation would last for a short period of time, and then we don't know what happened to it. But there's a hill or a mountain near Wan Son Harbor that I put a team out three times, and they would stay there maybe three or four months. And then they would conceal their gear, exfiltrate back through the lines, get a little R&R, retrain new targets and fresh equipment, and take them back and drop them. And they operated more in a tactical mode because they're observing movement along the roads and tracking the different type identify the Chinese or North Korean units.
Okay. Mr. Lee, Colonel Dillard's mentioned the North Koreans here, who were the backbone of this operation, these operations, who were actually going into North Korea. You were one of these North Koreans involved in this. How did you come to be? How did you come to meet Colonel Dillard, or then Lieutenant Dillard, and get connected with these activities?
They asked me to go to Daegu and then join this particular group as 8240 or so Forest Command. This detachment, but this was special operation, and it was just they got this operation established, and then I was recruited as a translator and a helper for the program. And I was a Korean guy, was trained, rather born and raised in China, in Shanghai, spoke fluent Chinese, so we used him as a Chinese translator, and I was acting as a translator between Chinese, Korean guys spoke fluent Chinese, and then American project officer. That was my job. And the purpose of the program was to collect information on the Chinese Communist Forces, CCF, Chinese Communist Forces, CCF, troops moving south. Didn't have any way to find out what's going on, because we came back from North Korea, retreated from North Korea, and then Chinese were dead there, or they just keep coming south, and then we need to collect intelligence information on these Chinese troops. So that was our operation, and I was very much limited, and then could not talk about the operation to begin with.
It was very secret. So sometimes you would actually go out on the aircraft with agents or with partisans who were being dropped in. You'd fly with them.
That was not my area, but they were already recruited and trained and then well trained. And our job was to get the target from G2 Division G2s, and then get a target and then drop them off by the aviary people, drop them off at the target and have them travel all the way together with Chinese forces to the front. And then they jump across the line and then we pick them up. And I picked them up and then bring them back to Seoul and then debrief them and then provide the report to the headquarters G2. We had about 82 to 85% success.
What do you mean by success?
82 to 85% of those agents we dropped, they came back through. Some of them didn't make it, got killed or some got lost, didn't come back. But 82 to 83, around that number. And I thought we had a pretty good success in our mission to collect information on Chinese forces coming south, moving south. And the G2 Army, rather Washington, U.S. Army G2 front page had report on from those agents we penetrated and came back with reports.
Help us imagine something here. So you'd sometimes be on these aircraft that were flying over North Korea or behind North Korean lines, ready to drop agents. What would the mood be like? Presumably these flights are happening in the middle of the night. What's it like on that airplane with, you know, sitting alongside these people who are about to jump into enemy territory at tremendous risk to their lives?
I felt like after all, these are my people, my teams. So I should go on a mission as far as I could go. And I wanted to go as far as I can go, that is, to drop some by air. So I went with a team, every team, our Chinese team, and get on the aviary section aircraft called the Baker Flight at Yoido, and then flew to the destination. And then I packed on their back and said, well, good luck, and you come back, and I'll pick you up and then bring you back to our detachment. So that was my job. And then I bring them back, and I debrief them on their mission, and collected information, and then provide the information to G2, IAM, and back to Washington, and so forth.
Might I add to that?
Yeah, please.
On the flights, and I think I've probably dropped 500 agents or partisans during the year I was there. None of them ever hesitated.
To jump out of the plane?
That's right. And we get them in the plane. It's very quiet. And, of course, there's a communication problem in being able to speak to them either in Korean or Chinese. And Mr. Lee, of course, handled his group very well, being aboard the aircraft. But they were given the sign. They knew it when the red light came on, they were to stand up. We trained them just like we train our own people. And I never had one hesitate. They were ready to go.
Dedicated people.
Yeah.
Had a mission. Were there security issues? Were there security problems you faced? Did the North Koreans or the Chinese attempt to penetrate your operations? And did you, in fact, lose a significant number of agents once they were dropped?
Yeah. As the war settled down and everything became more stabilized, therefore it became more organized. And the security nets really tightened up, so it became much more difficult to run an operation, and therefore there were many, many compromises as a result of that, both in the agent operation and in the partisan operations. As a matter of fact, on the East Coast, Jack Singlob was there at the time. He was a major, and I dropped some supplies for some of his people, but they were running operations on the East Coast, and it was so difficult that they just pulled out.
Major Singlaub, if I recall correctly, was working for CIA at
the
time.
Yeah, he ran Jack.
He was a famous member of the OSS, operated right. with mm-hmm. one of the Jedburgh teams in France, and later on went to an illustrious and somewhat controversial career as a military intelligence officer.
But it became more difficult as the time went on to do the operation, and I think that in some of the other cases, there were losses due to maybe negligence or the fact that, let me start at the beginning. When in August 1950, 14 special agents of CIC, the Counterintelligence Corps, U.S. Army, Japan, 441 CIC, they sent 14 agents over to Korea, and they became part of the initial development of the First Command Liaison Group. And they formed the first TLO teams, and they went out to both U.S. and Korean units.
And they went in and recruited wholesale high school classes of young high school students. They were the first TLO line crossers. And many of them worked throughout the period of hostilities in that manner. There were lots of losses, you know, not only from being captured, but some of them just wanted to go back home. I know that. I've had someone tell me that I dropped up north and said, well, you know, what really was your motivation? He said, I want to go back and see my family. And he appeared 2 months later, and he was debriefed and everything, and hadn't been captured, but that's what his motivation was. So he had a lot of success in some of the orientations there were more successful than, across the board, because we did lose a lot of people. And at the same time, we also collected a lot of valuable intelligence.
Mr. Lee, you mentioned one case of sabotage that occurred at one point. Can you tell us about that?
So, as I mentioned earlier, I went on every mission to the target, and then I put the pad on the back of the Aegis jumping off the airplane, and then I did it for each mission that we set. We had a young U.S. Army PFC just joined the Army, and came to Korea as a truck driver, supply truck driver. I think his name was Crab, and finished college and just got married with his co-ed, and came to Korea doing the job. And he kept saying, Mr. Lee, I'd like to go see what you can see from airplane at night. So I said, this is my country. I'm doing that because it's my country. But you're from United States. You're American. There's no need for you to take such a dangerous act. And I said, plus, you just got married. You're a married man. So there's no reason why you should take a chance. But kept asking me to let him go on a mission, just one time. So I said, you go to talk to Colonel Colonel Dupre, operations officer, to get permission. So he went to talk to Colonel Dupre. And Colonel Dupre called me up and said, Mr. Lee, Jimmy Lee, why don't you let him go one time? After all, he's helping you guys out quite a bit. So, okay. I briefed Pat on the back of agents getting on the airplane at the airport, and then he got on the airplane. I was supposed to go on the airplane. But as Gerard mentioned a while back, a couple of them, the Chinese, threw hand grenade back into the airplane when they jumped off the airplane, so it was sabotage. I think there's only about one team did that. And then there's only aircraft that we lost during the war. And so I felt like I was a guilty person, really. I couldn't sleep at night. Because he forced me out and he went my place. I was supposed to go on a mission to the point. But anyway, Colonel Dupre and then whoever was commanding officer told me not to go on the mission any longer. It's not because they don't want me to take a chance, but I know too much about the operation and so forth. So from now on, you pat on their back before they get on the airplane, and then you don't get go on the mission anymore.
Well, it's sort of a grim story. Last two questions, and maybe we can hopefully lighten the mood a little bit after that sobering story. Colonel Dillard, one thing I noticed in your book on this, and I should take the opportunity to mention, you've written a book called Tiger Hunters, Special Right. Operations in Korea Behind the Lines of the Chinese and North Korean Forces, 1950 to 1953. One of the things I noted with interest in your book was your discussion of pigeons in the context of the 8240th. Can you tell us just for a minute about what that's all about?
Yes. I think the 8240th Army was the last unit to use carrier pigeons. And the idea was to try and determine, did our agents land okay? And did they go to their target? So the conception at that point was we'd equip each team with a pair of pigeons. And after they landed, they would release one pigeon at daylight because they don't fly at night.
The pigeons don't fly at
night. The pigeons, and it would let us know that they did land safely. And then the second pigeon would be released, within 24 hours to let us know they reached their target. And the problem we had was, and I had to caution them at the last minute, is do not eat the pigeon because we know that that's happened. But the aside to that is the Army sent over, I think, about 82 pigeons they had trained. And that didn't work out. So 8th Army organized its own pigeon loft and had a training center set up in Japan. And they began to train and extend the distance, the return distance for the pigeons. And we had about up to 250-mile range with the pigeons that were trained in Japan. And the pigeoneers, then we got a few that were more experienced in handling them. But it's a whole new endeavor, and I could talk about that for a couple of hours on handling the pigeons. But Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, was the signal center. And they finally deactivated their operation while the Korean War was still going on.
Well, I think we all just learned something there. Last question for both of you. Looking back on it, and gosh, it's been coming up on 60 years now since the end of the Korean War. Looking back on it, what contribution did do you believe these agent operations and these partisan operations made to the Korean War? What does this all add up to in your minds?
My personal opinion that the Chinese operation we had, that helped the United Nations, U.S. forces, and the Koreans fighting against Chinese communist forces moving to the south. So I think that our work made a contribution to the success of our mission to stop communists moving any further south. I think it was a successful operation.
Colonel Dillard?
I agree with what Mr. Lee says. I would add that for the Incheon landing, Commander Park, Commander Clark had been sent over, but he knew about the date of the Incheon landing, and he went over and with a couple of Koreans, and I think a Japanese officer, and they liaison with some partisans at off the coast at Walmido and Palmido. And a reconnaissance, they did a lot of recon in that area to gather data that the fleet would use on their invasion. They captured the island of Palmido and activated the searchlight so that the fleet could guide on that, which you'd think it was a total marine operation, but that ain't so. I mean, the force was, but they did all the groundwork. He then went up to Taewado, which is just off the mouth of the Yellow River, and he was one of the first to report Chinese coming into North Korea. This was reported by our unit. There's no question about that. How they interpret it in Japan is another question. So I think that using those examples that during the period of hostilities, their unit with either intelligence gathering or partisan operations contributed a hell of a lot to the war effort. And as I said earlier, the partisan forces on the West Coast there were really the force on the left flank of First Corps that occupied the required the Chinese to have a full division over there protecting the West Coast and that area around the Guangdong province. So it was a formidable force, particularly as we began to get into early 53. With the inclusion of the partisan forces as part of the overall order of battle plan and being one of the flank forces with I Corps. And a lot of people, they get focused on, well, gee, you lost all these people. You don't make an omelet without breaking an egg. And yes, it's going to happen. But I think that we did a good job and we're proud of it and we're very sorry for any loss. And we still have about 8 of the special operations people that are missing in action. And we know that, except for Crabb, they were alive when they were in the hands of either North Korean or Chinese.
Well, thank you very much. You both have much to be proud of. Let me thank you for your service and your contributions in both in the Korean War and also subsequently. And thank you also for a wonderful conversation here at the International Spy Museum. We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we'll see you next month.